building bridges, not walls, with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
We now present part two of our two-part program.
Are the chickens coming home to roost again? Well, it's a new day of infamy, but it's rooted in centuries-old white supremacy.
The far-right siege on the U.S. Capitol has been called unbelievable, shocking, and beyond imagination. But let's not forget the attacks on state houses around the nation and all the symbols hate deployed. Guillotine, hangman's noose, Confederate and Nazi iconography, though they received far less coverage.
The playbook for the MAGA invasion of the nation's Capitol building has been developing for years in plain sight at far-right rallies in cities like Charlottesville, Berkeley, and Portland, and then in the past year at state capitals across the country, where heavily armed white protesters have forced their way into legislative chambers to accuse politicians of tyranny and treason.
The far right's fears about replacement of the white race and outsider invasions, and its anger is routinely stoked by the President of the United States and his cronies. White nationalism is closer to the mainstream of American politics than ever before.
But it's not the first, and it won't be the last eruption of the white supremacist violence we experience. Let's not get fooled thinking the 25th Amendment, impeachment, prosecutions of insurrectionists and or those in power who incited violent sedition will end this. Historians are rightly making connections to the Civil War, including declaring the Confederacy finally stormed the Capitol. But white supremacy goes deeper than the Civil War. It is foundational to the U.S. settler state.
Let's learn our history and let's start showing up for racial justice, against poverty and for economic justice, as internationalists and against militarism.
We're joined now by Eric Ward, Executive Director and Senior Fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center and Race Forward.
Eric Ward is Executive Director of Western State Center, a national hub for innovative responses to white nationalism and structural inequality. Ward is a nationally recognized expert on the relationship between authoritarian movements, hate violence, and building toward inclusive democracy.
What we saw on the street of D.C. as part of this insurrection was a large array of organizations and ideologies that have joined under the banner of Trumpism. They included the Proud Boys, a organization that describes itself as Western chauvinist. This is an unarmed paramilitary formation that has been engaging in street battles and attacks on Black Lives Matter protesters and others for nearly 5 years. It is the Proud Boys who were most visible in their call for a rally, in their use of political violence, but they were not the only ones. Other individuals belonging to organizations like the Three Percenters, an armed paramilitary organization that believes that it only takes 3% of the American public to overthrow the United States, had gathered. There were members of an organization called Oath Keepers that is made up of former military and law enforcement officers who participated. There were small grassroots organizations such as Veterans for Trump out of Southern California who joined. There were the Boogaloo Boys, a chaotic, nihilistic far-right paramilitary formation that is made up of a loose network that has been responsible for the killing of at least two law enforcement officers previous to the attack on D.C. Just to say there was an array of organizations, but I also believe there was an array of interests that were on the streets. Certain significant money was raised to help individuals get to D.C. How significant is that fundraising? We think it's very significant. Enrique Tarrio, one of the head of the Proud Boys nationally, was arrested entering D.C. 2 days before the protest. He was arrested because in a previous protest, he had attacked a historic black church, ripping down a Black Lives Matter banner and setting it on fire, and then admitted to doing so on social media. He was arrested at the airport, and when they arrested him, they also confiscated two high-capacity clips for weapons. These two high-capacity clips meant, right, that the individual could load significantly more rounds of ammunition into these clips. He was banned from D.C. But after he was arrested, within 72 hours, he had raised in excess of $80,000 in contributions. This is to say that this social movement, in many ways, functions just like other social movements. There are donors, there are foundations, there are individual contributors. It is a grassroots movement as well as a grasstops movement. Everyone should understand, it wasn't just the individuals who breached the joint session of Congress. It is the individual law enforcement officers who allowed it to happen. And I believe in some cases willfully allowed it to happen, putting even their law enforcement colleagues in risk. We know that one individual law enforcement officer was killed, crushed by a door and crushed over the head with a fire extinguisher because other law enforcement officers chose to side with the insurrection that day. We know that individuals like Rudy Giuliani actually said in a speech that day that the election should be decided as if it were trial by combat. Donald Trump himself on that day announced to the crowd that he would lead a march on Congress. We should understand that at the end of the day, the social movement that is known as the alt-right, that is driven by white nationalism, is as diverse as any other social movement in the United States. And if we want to know how it functions, we merely need to look at how our own social movements function. The difference is our social movements are grounded in inclusion. Our movements for civil rights, whether we are talking about Black Lives Matters, right, whether we are talking about the women's rights movement, whether we are talking about labor, whether we are talking about the original 1960s civil rights movement, has delivered more for white America than white nationalism and white supremacy has ever delivered for white America. Nevertheless, lasting socialization of white supremacy, the unwillingness of elected officials to stand up against white nationalism, and the unwillingness of our own social movements to take other social movements seriously that are grounded in exclusion led to the events of a growing, powerful social movement that nearly overthrew our Congress. We should be clear that there were individuals in that grouping who were set to do harm. They had zip ties. They had already physically hurt and damaged gave injuries to a law enforcement officer that led to his death. It appears that some of these individuals knew exactly the offices they were targeting and how to find them. I have been in those spaces. I can tell you as an individual that offices are not easy to find and to navigate in those spaces without knowing where you're going. And so we should understand that this wasn't just a failure of misunderstanding the threat. There was a willfulness among some actors within the federal government, elected, right, and civil servants, who allowed these events to take place. And it is important that they're held accountable in ways that reinforce the rule of law and don't undermine our constitutional rights.
How do you look at the Republican Party as a whole, particularly some of its members who have risen to the forefront in this, such as Hawley and Cruz? And of course, now we have QAnon members who are actually in the seat of government who have been elected. The role of the Republican Party in egging on helping to consolidate in some ways and give real voice to this grouping of the alt-right?
There were a number of elected officials who created space for this. I want to distinguish that between those who created space and those who specifically egged on or participated in the insurrection through their presence. There were a half a dozen state lawmakers who were involved in this insurrection. It wasn't just in D.C. Here in Portland, Oregon, where Western State Center is based, a state representative was involved in facilitating a breach of the state capitol. Two Seattle police officers have been placed on administrative leave for participating in the insurrection. Reports are beginning to surface all around the country of elected officials and civil servants who participated in this. And I think it's important that their names continue to be listed once it can be proven and established through legal procedure that it is true that these individuals were involved and participated. Do I believe folks should be held accountable? Absolutely.
Should we call this fascism? Is that what the Ted Cruz's, the Rudy Giuliani's, is that what the Donald Trump's have now philosophically and actually taken on? Are the forces in government who are facilitating and supporting these disparate groups, it would seem, but have come together for some purpose, your senses as white nationalists, is this fascism? Do we need to call it that and understand that what Pauly, Cruz, Trump, and various other elements of government, including many of the people that were in Trump's cabinet, whether they are in the last couple of days, possibly for career purposes, resigning or not, is this what fascism looks like?
I will leave it to the academic to debate whether this is or should be called fascism or not. I think has little relevance in this moment. The reason why is we are not in Europe. We live in a society, for the most part, where the political majority historically has never been a victim of fascism. It doesn't have an experience. Fascism is primarily a European experience. If this were happening within Europe, it is perhaps a term that I would use because Europeans would understand what that means. Here in the United States, for 50 years now, people use fascism to mean all kinds of things. Your parents get called fascists. The media gets called fascist. The elected official you don't like, regardless of their political perspective, gets called a fascist. Fascism doesn't carry the same meaning here. And so I hesitate to use it, even if it might be the academic, accurate description of what occurred. The more accurate term of what occurred here is that we saw an anti-democratic, small d, right, not Democratic Party, democracy, an anti-democratic insurrection that occurred in the United States that was willing to install an ideology of an authoritarianism in order to undercut the U.S. Constitution and the rule of law. At the end of the day, we are dealing with an authoritarian movement. And an authoritarian movement that may be less committed to its own white nationalism and more committed to political power and political rule. It's too early to say yet, but certainly authoritarian, anti-democratic, seeded with racism and anti-Semitism as part of the working mechanism of how it builds its base. What we should all understand is whatever we call it, it is a serious threat that at the end of the day, our democratic institutions, small d, seem unwilling to take this threat seriously. And it has left the American public, it has left our Constitution, and apparently even members of law enforcement physically and politically vulnerable. That is a disaster for 75 years of civil rights gains in this country.
In terms of not taking this threat seriously, I know that there is a planned convergence on Washington, D.C. and numerous state capitals throughout the country. What are the plans that these groups have for those days in terms of surveillance, in terms of stopping this, in terms of controlling it?
Such a good question. The truth is this is where we get into consequences and unintended consequences. We believe, yes, there have been calls for a convergence on D.C. for January 17th through January 20th. There are actually several calls that are now circulating. My sense is, at this point, I hope everyone understands that we need to take these movements grounded in exclusion at their word, that they seek to converge on Washington, D.C. I don't think we need to debate whether that is really their intent or not. It is. We should also not debate whether these groups are committed to violence. We now have a 5-year track record that has established that these groups are more than willing to use political violence through physical attacks, through the use of weapons, and the use of explosives, right, in order to achieve their ends. It is not a debate anymore. And three, if those two things can't make our society take this moment seriously, we should understand, right, that one way of looking at what we may have observed on January 6th in Washington, D.C., was a dry run to prove that, in fact, these buildings are indeed vulnerable, that elements of law enforcement will stand aside. And so I think we should be very clear that these threats are both imminent and they're serious. But how we respond to them is also critically important. We can't respond in panic, right? It calls for disciplined response. You cannot defend the rule of law, right, and rights in this country by undermining the rights and the rule of law of others. So it takes real intention to both de-escalate and remove the ability of these individuals to attempt to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power that is essential to any inclusive democracy and is certainly historic and traditional to how the U.S. government has governed. So I think many of these things will happen. There are many things that can be done. Why aren't we seeing a lot of chatter around plans? Well, many of these individuals have been deplatformed off of social media that most Americans use. So you're not seeing these discussions on Twitter and Facebook. There has been some law enforcement crackdown, and I want to emphasize some, because I can tell you without a doubt, if this had been done by a civil rights movement or an environmental social movement, right, and elected officials had joined into those actions and 5 people would have been killed in these events, I can guarantee you that there would be many more arrests that would have occurred by now. And I can tell you that there would have been many more injuries of those who engaged in those activities in D.C. We're not seeing the chatter because some of the arrests have chilled, right, the willingness of the white nationalist movement and its alt-right coalition to talk about these things openly and publicly. The third is that this growing split within the Republican Party has made it unclear, likely, to elements who they can or cannot coordinate with in this moment.
One of the concerns that you and I had spoken about and that I know is shared with Ken is the question of how to respond without inadvertently falling into a constriction of our own forms of protest or expression, assemblage, civil liberties. Having said that, how do we respond, and what are your thoughts about a permanent banning from social media, which has, of course, been done to colleagues of mine on issues of great import? They have been censored, particularly around the issue of Palestine and the like. So how do we not fall into a trap of, in our exuberance or fear, to discipline the perpetrators of abuses to the social norm and the social process, and or indeed involved in and directly relevant to people dying? How do we proceed such as not to hamper, destroy our own civil liberties?
I think this is the most important question. I think the most important piece is we have to resist being turned into reactionaries because of political terror. We have to understand that authoritarianism, right, doesn't just arise from the far right and the white nationalist movement and its alt-right forces. The idea of authoritarianism right now is mainstream, right? It is the alt-right and the white nationalist movement tapping into something that is in the air we breathe right now. We are not alone in that in the United States. Authoritarianism has anchored itself as a theory of change, and all of us who care about rights, who care about equality, have to understand, right, that we have to shield and inoculate ourselves from those authoritarian tendencies. The way to do that in this moment, I say this as someone who has been involved in organizing against the white nationalist movement, helping communities respond for over three decades, is this. We first have to understand that our goal is not the destruction of the white nationalist movement. Our goal is to ensure that we have inclusive democracy in America, people-centered, transparent, and accountable governance. That is the best defense against white nationalist tendencies. The second is we have to understand the rule of unintended consequences, that the things that we do out of fear and concern can have larger, right, repercussions on rights in our own social movement. So we have to be careful that we are really adhering, right, to the rule of law, right, to values, and understanding that our values, in fact, in this moment, are more important than our ideologies, right, which are merely vehicles for us to express our values. And what I mean by that is when we call for the use of the 25th Amendment, when we call for impeachment, I'm not saying we shouldn't do so, and I'm not saying that I don't support those calls. What I'm saying is we should at least consider, why are elements on the right calling for those same things? And in this case, I would tell people to think about the historic moment about the overthrow of the Shah in Iran, where the fundamentalist religious right in Iran joined forces with the political left in Iran to oppose the Shah, right? The Shah was a brutal dictator, right? Removing the Shah from power makes sense. But we have to ask ourselves, where is the left in Iran today, and what happened? And we have to be careful as we move forward around making sure we don't undermine our own democratic infrastructure, small d, in this society, democratic infrastructure that it has taken 75 years to build, as John Lewis said, right, that we have moved, right, from the idea of democracy as an aspiration to democracy being real, and that is because of over 75 years of civil rights struggle. Civil liberties cannot just be tossed to the side because they are inconvenient. One of the unintended consequences, and I'm a person who believes, right, that some of these individuals should be removed from Twitter and Facebook, but one of the unintended consequences is by removing, we have actually helped them and forced them to build their own alternative platforms. They may not be as vibrant as a Facebook or a Twitter, but it still allows them to communicate in a way now that makes it hard for us to monitor and to understand and interject in. We just have to be careful in this moment and understand that for every action, there is a reaction, and we need to understand what those reactions are. It has been, but I do want to acknowledge it's been a hard year. We've had to deal with the specter of a global pandemic that has now taken over nearly 380,000 American lives, is likely to take probably somewhere around 500,000, right, before we get this under control due to the failures of the present administration. We have record unemployment. Our economy is in shambles when it comes to income equality in our society. We have been dealing with political violence over the last year that has taken the lives of racial justice protesters, law enforcement, and including individuals in the far right. It has been a burdensome year, and it's easy to want to try to retreat or to believe this idea that there is a civil war or a race war brewing in America. That is white nationalist propaganda. The truth is that our movements for justice and equity are winning. And what we are seeing, right, is a reactionary insurrection. It is a reaction to the fact that social equity in America, economic justice in America, is actually winning, right? It is actually capturing the imagination of Americans across lines of race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity. We have to use our voices in this moment. You have to be an organization, and you have to begin to talk to other folks around what you will do if there is a real attempted coup in the United States. How will you respond? Defend democracy by choosing to do one thing. Figure out that one thing. Make it count. We are in a moment where whatever it is we would have done in the midst of the 1960s civil rights movement is exactly what you are going to do when this conversation ends. Make it count. Defend democracy.
Eric Ward, Executive Director and Senior Fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center and Race Forward, and Executive Director of Western States Center, a national hub of innovative responses to white nationalism and structural inequality. Thank you for joining us. To all our listeners, stay strong, stay well, educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people, for a better world is possible. And we are the ones to make it so.